This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. An historic night for Boston has the city in the national spotlight.
City Councilor Michelle Wu, set to become the next mayor, first Asian American, first woman of color.
36 years
old. The moderate challenger conceded. It's interesting that she's a progressive.
Mm-hmm, big time.
In the city of Boston.
It was a convincing win.
Michelle Wu's sweeping victory tonight across almost every neighborhood across the board. Michelle Wu won neighborhoods like the North End and Charlestown. Places like Alston, Brighton, and Jamaica Plain cast more ballots than South Boston did.
Sound there from CNN's Don Lemon first, and then Massachusetts Democratic political analyst Marianne Marsh on WCVB Channel 5. Mayor-elect Wu held a sizable lead in the polls throughout the race, and those voters showed up at the polls.
Her vision for the city I find inspiring, and she's smart and she's clear, and she has a track record.
South End voter Peter Hawkins there. Now, in her victory speech last night, Wu made it clear she wants to use her decisive win to drive her progressive agenda.
From every corner of our city, Boston has spoken. We are ready to meet this moment. We are ready to become a Boston for everyone.
Wu's opponent, City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George, says even though she's conceding, she will continue to fight for Boston and its residents.
This race may technically be over, but the work is not done. Our work is not done. It's going to take every single one of us, and I promise you I'm never going to stop fighting for this city that I love. I am never going to stop fighting for the people that I love.
So much to unpack. Do that with us. Call us. Tell us what you think about the results last night, what you hope incoming Mayor Michelle Wu can do for the city of Boston, how you are feeling in this historic moment. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have guests helping us sort that out, and we're going to begin with Massachusetts State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz. Senator Chang-Diaz, welcome. I'm well, thanks. Happy to have you. And I guess I'll start. I do want to note you endorsed Wu in the race.
I sure did. I'm a proud member of the Wu train.
So what was your first thought when it became official last night?
Jubilation, right? I was there at the Cyclorama last night. Just the joy was palpable in the room. The energy was palpable in the room. Of course, you know, the historic nature of the race. But more than that, I think just the affirmation that Michelle's win represents of the real appetite, the hunger that people have for leadership that brings a sense of urgency to government and an ambition for solutions that match the scale of the problems that we face. I think, you know, it was a deep joy that I felt and others in the room I know felt for the affirmation of that message and the collective ambition that we should be, running toward problems to solve them and, you know, tackle them at their core.
Senator Chang-Diaz, I'm going to bring a second voice in here to join our conversation. President and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, Michael Curry. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So Senator Chang-Diaz was just telling me how she felt last night when the official results came through. Michael, what was your first thought?
Well, you know, I think about one and just honored to be on with the senator. And, you know, she represents the breaking through of the ceiling. You know, when we have leaders like the senator now, like Michelle Wu, ascending into these positions that were, quite frankly, historically relegated for white men, I'm celebrating the moment we're in and excited that there's a new perspective at the table that will address women's issues, maybe be bolder on people of color issues in the city of Boston. And then it's on all of us, the senator, myself, and others, to hold Mayor Wu accountable to do what she needs to do to meet the challenges. So there's a lot of work to do, but we should celebrate, take pause and celebrate this historic moment.
So, Michael, I know you were connecting and may not have heard it, Senator Chang-Diaz. I know you did, but I'll paraphrase for both of you because we had some sound right at the top there of CNN's Don Lemon, basically expressing surprise that Boston had elected a progressive mayor. Now, there were degrees of progressive in this race, but certainly all the candidates were left of center, and the country has been watching. How important is it, Senator, in this moment to Boston's reputation in the rest of the country?
Well, Tiziana, I think it's hard to overstate, honestly. You know, it's not lost on me. And I'm sure, you know, Michael and his role at the National Board of the NAACP probably get some of this too, right? It's not lost on me the perception that people from outside of Massachusetts have of Boston. And so I do think this is an important, you know, breakthrough moment and signal for our city on the national stage, showing to folks some of the things that we have known to be true and sort of nascent and emerging in Boston's politics over the last 5, maybe 10 years, you know, if you really look back at the seeds. So I think this is a hugely important moment for Boston on the national stage.
And I want to ask that same question to listeners. How important is it for the city of Boston, the country's watching, arguably parts of the world are watching this historic change in this Boston mayoral race? How important is it to the city's reputation to have achieved this first? Share your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael, I'll invite you to build on that. And also, are you thinking any differently about the city?
Yeah, I mean, for those of us, like myself, the senator, many other advocates and activists across the city, we know that it's a tale of two cities, using the Dickens quote, a tale of two cities. It is a city that, as Michael Chase said, is a racist city, and we still have vestiges of racism here. That's, we see it in all aspects of society. But we also know this is a city that still elected Councilor Ayanna Pressley, now Congresswoman Pressley, and she topped the ticket at large, that Michelle Wu topped the ticket at large, that white, black, brown residents from across the city voted for a candidate of color even prior to this election. So we've been improving in terms of how we embrace the rich diversity of the city. This is just that next step forward. Doesn't mean we're there yet. Doesn't mean that we're that ideal city on the hill that's inclusive, that's equitable, but it means this is a huge step in the right direction.
So Michael Che, being both a black comedian and a member of the Saturday Night Live cast, who had famously made the comments you were talking about, there is so much significance. Before last night, for the first time, we had two women of color as front runners. Today, we have our first woman, first mother, first person of color, first Asian American mayor in this city's history. I want to play a little sound from the town hall that WBUR did with Michelle Wu. I was in conversation with her, and she shared with me how her upbringing has molded her throughout the years and how it's shaped her sense of responsibility.
At my core, I am still the daughter of immigrants who remembers what it was like growing up with all-powerful parents inside the safety of our home. But as soon as we crossed over the doorstep into the outside world, I would be pushed out front as the translator and interpreter for our family.
I was so struck, both before the preliminary, Senator Chang Diaz, and especially after, how much, because we were going to be looking at a race where there was a new identity in the mayor's office, right? How much personal story and identity really mattered. I'd love to invite you to reflect on that and maybe also what this win can mean for Boston's Asian American community.
Yeah, Tiziana, I'm so glad that you played that clip because, you know, among the first and the sort of the qualities of breakthrough that I think Michelle's candidacy represents, you know, first woman elected as mayor, first Asian American, first person of color, I think it's really important to keep on that list that she is, although I'll note here, you know, Mayor Walsh, I think also fit this category, but that she is a first generation American. And that she really, I think, is a person that the new American and new Bostonians across our city can see themselves in, and that she, you know, that experience so deeply informs the sensibilities that she's going to bring to City Hall, I think is hugely important as well. And you mentioned also being a mom. I have to say, this one is along with being a first generation American, also really important to me on a personal level, right? I mean, Michelle and I sort of are, you know, we both had our kids in office, you know, remember sort of changing diapers on the table in meetings with her. You know, seeing a working mom, you know, take this executive leadership role, I think is also breaking a lot of important barriers and will continue to do so over the time of her mayoralty. Is it mayoralty? Mayorship?
Mayoralty, mayoralty. Time being mayor is what we're going to say. Michael, do you know what the actual phrase is?
I think it's mayoralty.
Mayoralty, okay.
I can't say it.
So, Senator Chang Diaz, you brought up several threads I'd like to pull there, but I'm going to start with the first generation American because Anissa Saibi George's identity was also a central part of her campaign, her Arab American heritage, her Boston roots. But later in the race, her accent, and it's as if her identity played out on a different track. We also had a town hall with her. Here she is talking about controversy over the way she leaned into her accent.
My father came here as a young man, spoke very little English. My mother happened to speak French. That's how they communicated, and had a heavy, heavy accent. And I know as a convenience store worker, as a taxi cab driver, as a hotel worker, that he was mocked for his accent.
Michael, that became a loaded part of this race. It also became part of this larger conversation we were having about who is Boston. And I want to ask you, are we in the process of redefining who is Boston?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for any of us who are students of history, we were always a city of immigrants, right? This was the story of Boston, right? Even as those Irish folks came after the potato famine and we started to populate a strong Irish population here, or Italian, and the many other communities, we've always welcomed and received, not always welcomed, but we've always had newcomers into the city. That is part of our rich tradition in the city. The problem is that we've relegated some communities to the back of the bus. We've relegated some communities to not having equal access to opportunities because of where they came from, or the language they speak, or the country of origin. That is what is changing. We can no longer tolerate that. So if you are Haitian on this call, if you are Cape Verdean, if you are Latinx from Honduras, or name the country, Boston now needs to be a city that embraces all of that diversity. And Michelle's win should be a testament to that change in Boston.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255, to join this conversation. We've got Nick on the line in the North End. Nick, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, I think that Michelle Wu really identified herself as a climate activist throughout her campaign. And I think, you know, her win last night really sends the signal that Boston's going to, you know, going forward, take climate action really seriously, you know, given that Boston is such a vulnerable city with a rising sea level.
Thanks for the call, Nick. And Senator Chang Diaz, that's really interesting. I mean, we heard in her victory speech, her acceptance speech, you know, last night, her emphasis again on the city's Green New Deal. It's in my mind that COP26 is also happening right now. We're having a global conversation about climate and climate change. So, you know, is this another place where Michelle Wu stands primed to straddle the line between what is local and what is global?
For sure, for sure. And I want to thank Nick for helping us make the pivot there, because as much as it is, I think, you know, valuable and important for, as Michael said, for us to take a beat and celebrate and acknowledge the victory and savor the historic nature of the race in terms of identity, you know, representation at the table of power. Michelle's candidacy was so much more than identity politics. I mean, so much more. I mean, she really, the room that I was in last night at the Cyclorama, I think, you know, it was an extraordinary room. There aren't that many like it in Boston that did. It was multi-generational. It cut across neighborhood lines. It cut across racial and ethnic lines. It cut across identity lines of all kinds. But I think the reason that is the case is because Michelle has articulated this bold vision and has backed it up with work and with results for years on the city council. And that's the kind of leadership ultimately that does, you know, that people are hungry for, no matter what, you know, race, ethnicity, gender, neighborhood, et cetera, that they're in, is they're looking for leadership that says, we're going to stop asking you to wait, right, another year, another 2 years, another term for us to do this, that, or the other. We are going to tackle these problems with ambition, and we're going to back them up with plans, and we're going to build the coalitions to actually put the win in the end zone. And she's done that, and I think that's why she was able to build trust across so many different racial, ethnic, and demographic lines last night.
So, Michael, as I'm listening to Senator Chang Diaz and I'm thinking about those big plans, the ambitions for change, the not waiting another 2 years or another 4 years, I'm hearing this kind of echoing clock, you know, tick, 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 because November 16th, Michelle Wu becomes mayor and starts the business of the city. I think about how long a presidential transition goes, goes on. I even think about the fact President Biden nominated Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins into a position she hasn't even had a confirmation vote yet, and it's 11 months into his term. So the idea that we're going to turn around in 2 weeks and get busy, where does one even start?
Yeah, well, I've been here twice before. When Governor Patrick won in 2006, I served on the transition team. At that time, I was at Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they had the governor designated, I think it was at that time, Cleve Killingsworth to serve on that transition team, and I staffed him. I was there when Mayor Walsh won and was served on that transition team. So the transition process starts now. Mayor Belzati in Brockton, I served on her transition team. This is the point where you get really smart people like the senator on this call and Sheriff Tompkins dealing with mass casts and Kim Janey, who's stepping out of the role as acting mayor. Get all these smart people in the room and you say, okay, what are the big problems we need to solve? And I know here's what I talked about on the campaign. What are your collective strategies? And let's sit in a room and figure out what we can map out together. That's what Governor Patrick did. That's what Mayor Walsh did in those early days. And she'll have a protracted time frame to do it. But she can do it. She'll make the phone call. She has a relationship. I want to just give credit. Senator Warren, who is a friend of mine, and I know a mentor of Michelle Wu. I'm a fan of Senator Warren's. And I just think that credit to her for producing in her leadership a generation of folks that are stepping up into these positions and leading. So I just want to give her credit for part of this victory.
We are talking on Radio Boston with State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz and Michael Curry, unpacking the results of last night's historic mayoral election, asking what's next for the city, what's next for incoming Mayor Michelle Wu. Senator Chang Diaz, I had a question for you, but I think you were just going to add on to what Michael said. So let me just turn right over to you.
Oh, I was just giving the, yes.
All right. So I am going to ask you a question then. So many, many serious issues. I mean, we are in the middle of a global pandemic still. We have a humanitarian crisis. I don't even want to say unfolding because it's not a big enough verb. But we have a humanitarian crisis at the neighborhood around Malnia Cass Boulevard and Massachusetts Avenue. We have economic needs. We're headed into winter. Where does a leader start? How does one comb out all that business? And what's the first couple things you gotta get right to start right?
Well, here again, I will agree with Michael and add his name to the list of smart people who should be in that room, right? I think that where you start is in, as a strong executive, is in recognizing that, look, if you're doing it alone, you're not doing enough. And so you've got to put a first-class team of people together so that you can, have all these force multipliers out there working on multiple challenges at once. My hope is that is where Michelle will start, and I'm confident that she will because she does have a strong team of people around her. And she's been in this work in the trenches for so many years. I think she knows, where a lot of that expertise lies.
Michael, and listening to that, I find myself thinking about a couple of early wins, and I'm wondering how important they are. The first one on my mind is police and the appointment of a new commissioner. One of the things I noticed in conversations with the candidates, Michelle Wu wants a national search. Anissa Tsibe-George did not. She was going to stay local and therefore was ready to commit to a faster turnaround. How important is that to get done quickly?
It is absolutely important. And I want to take the moment to just acknowledge, even though I appreciate Anissa Tsibe-George's remarks last night, her grace, her respect for the new mayor. I just want to point out that across the country, we saw something that did play out here as well, which is the fear politics. and this whole defunding the police, which was never really took root here in Boston and in Massachusetts. It was really about repositioning our dollars and our resources. And yet that was used as a fear tactic to get people to vote. And we talked about critical race theory and all these other issues across the country and the Virginia race. I just want to point out that I think we need to relook at how we do policing. That's a given. So I want to tell people right now, I'm pro-police, but I'm pro-police accountability, transparency, and respect. So if we're going to do this the right way, I think Michelle now will have the tools to do a national search, find the right person who's willing to be disruptive around how we do policing in Boston, and still, and you know, provide safety and security for our police officers so they get home to their families as well.
And State Senator Chang Diaz, what about the crisis at Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard and the area around it? Are there steps the mayor must take, the new mayor must take quickly and early on there that you're looking for?
Well, I think it's not just going to be on the new mayor, right? What we see going on at Mass and Cass really is at the intersection of state, local, and even, you know, federal policy. And look, I think this is a decent microcosm of other policy priorities that Michelle has articulated, that they are going to require partnership across levels of government. So it is going to certainly be on Mayor-elect Wu's plate. I think that we need to look closely at the early data points that we're seeing, you know, are just in the first week about, you know, is the new court session at Mass and Cass, you know, following through on the expressed purposes and the expressed values of getting people into treatment, you know, approaching the problem as a public health problem rather than a criminal one. But also she's going to need to work in coalition and in partnership with actors across levels of government, because the folks that are congregating at Mass and Cass are residents of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and not just of Boston. In many cases come from outside of Boston. And so we all do need to be at the table and take a slice of responsibility for putting multifaceted solutions in place at Mass and Cass.
Okay. And last word, Michael Curry, later in the show, we're going to talk about some of the other elections and races around the state. Anything else you were particularly watching?
Well, you know, I'm a huge Yvonne Spicer fan, and I know she lost her race out in Western Mass, but I just want to say thank you, Mayor Spicer, for your service. I know her mission is about service, so we'll see her in other places. And then I think just across the country, we knew that as we head towards midterms, there's going to be a backlash to the win by Biden and some politics playing out on the other side, and again, using critical race theory and anti-police rhetoric or pro-police rhetoric. We need to fight back with that and really talk about policy. How do we invest in people, resources, communities, equity, justice? And I think we just need to be on the ground doing that. So just credit to the senator and other people that are champions of that work.
All right. Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Massachusetts State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz. Thanks to you, too.
Thanks, Tiziana, and good to be with you, Michael.
Before the break, we were talking about the mayoral election in Boston, but it was not the only city to elect a new mayor last night. Voters in 55 Massachusetts cities and towns cast ballots, including in some pretty critical mayoral races. With most results in, it is not a cut-and-dry story. Some incumbents held seats, others lost, some communities voted in historic firsts, some repeated history. So we turned to Lisa Kaczynski, reporter for Politico and the author of the Massachusetts Playbook, to help us sort through it. Lisa and I talked earlier this afternoon, and we started with a truism in Massachusetts politics that the most important political force is not the D or R next to your name, but an I. For incumbent. Multiple incumbent mayors, though, lost their races in the state, including in Framingham, where first-term mayor Yvonne Spicer lost out to former city councilor Charlie Sosicki. So what happened?
Yeah, it's definitely a big deal for a few reasons. So Yvonne Spicer was the city's first mayor, just one-term mayor now, and she was also the first popularly elected Black female mayor in Massachusetts. So what happened here is basically, you know, she swept into office 4 years ago, and since she has dealt with a pandemic, she's clashed with counselors and made headlines for that, and is just a little bit, you know, kind of embattled, and people were getting dissatisfied with her leadership. Those were the headlines that you were seeing out of Framingham over the past year or so. And then she was challenged by Charlie Sosicki, who as a former city councilor and a longtime civic leader in Framingham was really popular and well-known. And that's always, you know, that's always a little bit of a challenge in and of itself when someone with a lot of name recognition goes to challenge an incumbent that maybe isn't as well-liked as in the beginning of her term, which of course tends to happen. But basically, as this race went on, you saw people who had supported Yvonne Spicer in the beginning start to go over to Charlie Sosicki. You saw a PAC, Massachusetts Majority PAC, that was backed by or affiliated with Governor Charlie Baker, I should say, start to put money behind the challenger. And you saw a real groundswell of support behind the challenger instead of the mayor. And, you know, at one point she had been decrying a potential Republican takeover of Framingham to get back at that PAC. So it was not a surprising result because she had finished behind Charlie Sosicki in the preliminary election. You know, he had more than doubled her vote total then, and he essentially did so again last night.
Is there some kind of symbolic whiplash or backlash here? I mean, you noted first Black elected woman mayor of any city in Massachusetts. One term later, the voters truly go in another direction. It's also interesting, you know, juxtaposed with Boston.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think the thing with these mayor's races is that they really come down to hyper-local issues, local government styles, and relationships within local government. And I think in the case of Framingham, despite kind of the first that Yvonne Spicer had behind her, that this really just came down to more of a local issue with her leadership style, with, you know, she kind of had a contentious relationship with some members of the city council from the very start. And I think that that really played a role here.
All right. So is that the same case that it's really down to local issues in Gloucester, where Mayor Safatia Romeo Taken also lost as the incumbent and unseated by former city councilor Greg Verga?
Yeah, there was a pretty similar story out of Gloucester, actually. You had an embattled mayor who had gotten headlines for having she'd had complaints filed against her, you know, over a toxic work environment, a similar lawsuit to that, resignations. So, yeah, she had kind of drawn similarly negative headlines, you know, both with her leadership style and over her parts of her handling of the pandemic, as Yvonne Spicer had in Framingham. And again, she was being challenged by, you know, a former city councilor. So kind of similar dynamics that played out in Gloucester, slightly different local issues, but kind of that same sort of thing where you had two incumbent mayors who were just embattled within their own communities and challenged by some pretty well-known names.
I have to take a time out for a second, you know, and just sort of say it really strikes me. This is two stories of women leaders who are getting pushback for their quote unquote leadership style, which is something that we've heard about in the study of gender leadership for a long time. Any discussion out there in the political spheres about the gender dimension of both of these losses?
I think you'll probably see that starting today. I mean, it's something that, for instance, people that I've worked with at the Barbara Lee Family Foundation have noted time and time again the challenges that women face in government, particularly incumbents, you know, they having to go that extra step, not just to do the work, but also, you know, prove that they've done it, show that they've done it, go that extra mile sometimes over, you know, male leaders, male incumbents. So I think that that will definitely be a topic of discussion, especially juxtaposed with what you saw in Boston and North Adams last night, who just elected their first female mayors. I think it will definitely be something that people will be trying to dissect going forward.
Why don't you actually talk about that North Adams race a little bit? It's an interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely. So North Adams has been on track to elect its first female mayor for a few months now, because all four candidates in the preliminary election were women, narrowed down to two. Now you have Jennifer Maxey, who's won. So you now have your first female mayor in North Adams.
So it's interesting, again, the parallel to Boston there.
Absolutely. Two very different cities on opposite sides of the state are taking the next step in their leadership with women for the first time.
All right. So another woman who was elected, we're going to stay on that theme. And this is an interesting one because I think lots of people are so used to, if you're in Somerville, the word mayor is followed by the word Curtatone. And that is now not going to be the case. We've got mayor-elect Katiana Ballantyne.
Yeah, for the first time in nearly two decades, Somerville has a new mayor. Yeah, they'll get used to, everyone will have to get used to switching over the names there. But yeah, so this was a race between two progressive city councilors. So still a progressive bastion over in Somerville, just with a different leader now. She is the second female mayor, I believe, in Somerville. So yeah, so definitely a good night over there for Katiana Ballantyne and progressives. One of the interesting things that played out in Somerville was actually in the city council races, where there had been a slate of Democratic Socialist candidates backed by the Boston chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, who had been vying to essentially pull off a city council takeover and make it a majority socialist city council. And they didn't quite get there. You know, good night for the left overall in Somerville, but only four of the seven Democratic Socialist candidates made it onto the council.
So, Lisa, I had really been watching with interest Lawrence, where acting Mayor Kendris Vasquez lost his seat to city councilor Brian DePena. And I understand, actually, Vasquez had actually received more votes than DePena in the primary election last September. The mayor of Lawrence has loomed large over the last few years between the Merrimack Valley gas explosion, issues in the Lawrence schools, et cetera. Tell us a little bit about, you know, both this outcome and why the flip after the preliminary.
That was really surprising. And I say this as someone who covered Lawrence for several years up at the Eagle Tribune, but has been a little bit removed from the city recently. I was surprised when I started getting texts last night and I saw that result, exactly because of what you just said about the preliminary election. And he had been acting mayor for almost a full year now. He had taken over when he was a city council president who, kind of like acting mayor Kim Janey, had taken over when the mayor of Lawrence at the time, Dan Rivera, left to go lead mass development. And he seemed to be pretty well liked. He'd been, you know, around city politics a lot longer than Kim Janey had been in Boston. So that seemed to have put him in a little bit better of a position going through his preliminary election earlier this year. But he was up again against, as you kind of saw, you know, he wasn't necessarily the incumbent in this, but he essentially was in an open seat race. And he was being challenged by another, you know, longtime community figure who was liked by the business community, had been on the city council before, and ultimately that won out.
So I do feel we've talked a lot about women mayors, women in races, women who won, women who lost. There were a couple of races with women who held. I'm thinking about Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll, who we had on the air here at Radio Boston recently. She had been the first elected woman in her city. You've got Ruth Ann Fuller in Newton. So some women incumbents did hold on.
Absolutely. And one of them, and also maybe not of a surprise in the Merrimack Valley, but an interesting result to those of us watching with eyes on the State House was Amesbury, where the mayor there held off a challenge from State Representative Jim Kelkhorst, you know, GOP state rep who was backed by Charlie Baker and the affiliated PAC. Baker had even cut a video for him on Facebook in the days leading up to the election, and he was unsuccessful. She held on to her seat.
So, you know, they say all politics are local, but these local elections happened in a national context. I mean, if you were watching a CNN last night, you were hearing about the gubernatorial races in Virginia, New Jersey, and the trouble they seem to show for Democrats across the country. So what are the lessons for Democrats more broadly in the Massachusetts races? And compare and contrast a little bit there.
Well, one of the big storylines, and I actually worked on this for Politico, I will plug that, is that, you know, Michelle Wu and, you know, also Katiana Ballantyne, progressives who won, you know, in Massachusetts last night, delivered some really key victories on a night when the left and the Democratic Party in general did not have a good night. And that's on top of an election year where you had already seen moderates winning races. You know, Eric Adams sealed the deal in New York after winning the primary earlier this year, you know, in the Ohio special congressional election. So it definitely, I think the you're seeing that a lot in the takes this morning, the dust settling. The Democrats are now trying to figure out, where do we go from here? This is not the message that they had wanted. You know, in Massachusetts, it's good. But, you know, in other parts of the country, it didn't pan out that way, particularly in mayor's races, you know, in Buffalo, in Seattle, for instance, in Minneapolis, progressives didn't make it, you know, didn't make the cut in the end. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of reevaluating and trying to figure out how to proceed, especially with essentially the midterms start today. So.
All right. All right. Lisa Kashinsky, reporter for Politico and the author of The Massachusetts Playbook. We will keep watching politics with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That is music by Tia Fuller, as played by animated saxophonist Dorothea Williams in the Pixar movie Soul. If you haven't seen it, Dorothea leads her band, the Dorothea Williams Quartet, and helps main character Joe pursue his dream of performing jazz on stage. Works great for the plot, but the reality is female jazz musicians are still relatively rare compared with their male counterparts. Oftentimes, even if women are on the stage, they are on an island surrounded by men. Terry Lynn Carrington knows the dynamic well, both as a jazz musician herself, also actually as a consultant behind Soul's music. But Carrington and others are looking to change that status quo with a new program at the Berklee College of Music. The Next Jazz Legacy will aim to mentor and nurture young women and non-binary jazz musicians. Their inaugural class will launch this winter, with applications being accepted now till the end of November. And here to talk more about the program is Terry Lynn Carrington, chair of the Next Jazz Legacy and founder of the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. Terry Lynn, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
It's exciting to have you. And forgive me, but I'm actually going to start by playing a little bit more music, your music. This is you playing Blackbird by the Beatles with the house band for the Arsenio Hall show. You were the show's house drummer, as I understand it. Let's take a listen. So I wanted to play that for you because in watching the video, Terry Lynn, you are a woman in almost entirely surrounded by men. Talk about that, this place of women in jazz.
Well, that's been the case throughout my whole career. I got my union card when I was 10, I think, here in Boston. And I'm 56, so I've had 46 years of professional drumming so far. And it's always been dominated by men. And I just took that as the way it is, and I accepted it, and I thought that was normal. And about 5 years ago or so, I started really feeling like we needed to make more space, you know, not in a couple of years, not 10 years down the line, but right now. And that's when I started the Institute at Berklee. But this program is a partnership with New Music USA. And Vanessa Reed, who's the president and CEO of New Music USA, we've been concocting this for about a year and a half. And, you know, very pleased with the fact that we're able to do it through the funding of Mellon Foundation, and will affect at least 20 young women and non-binary performers within the next 3 years.
So, you know, I know a study done by NPR Music Jazz Critics poll in 2019 showed that fewer than 16% of artists on jazz records were women, for example. What will this program do for upcoming jazz artists who are women, who are non-binary, to help change the landscape of the genre?
Well, I think we'll draw more attention to the fact that young women and non-binary artists need to be mentored more and have these types of apprenticeship situations to really get their playing on the level that they want it to be. Because often what happens is women end up playing together because that's the community they're in, and they're not able to necessarily always break through with some of their male colleagues that they want to play with, or their people they look up to. So they end up playing together or becoming band leaders maybe a little too early before they're ready. Because I know that most of the people that I know that are great they really studied under somebody. When I say study, I don't mean at a school. I mean on stage, traveling, learning on the job. And that's really the only way you can learn how to play jazz. So this program is to help these 20 women that will affect in the next 3 years, help them find apprentice situations.
I want to talk a little bit more about that apprenticeship. You know, I feel like in the last couple of years, especially in the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement, we've started to have a more in-depth conversation about both the experiences of women in the workplace, but also mentorship and what's been missing in bringing up the next generation. And now we're increasingly having that same conversation for members of the non-binary community, the LGBTQ community. How essential is somebody bringing you up to being able to take the next step in a career as just unbelievably competitive, I'm assuming, as jazz?
Yes, it's extremely competitive. And when young people graduate from college, if they go to college, you don't have to have graduated from college to be in this program. But when you do graduate and you go into the professional world, the competition is great. In fact, when I graduated, well, I didn't graduate from Berkeley, but when I left Berkeley in 1983, I think it was, 84, my mentor, Jack DeJohnette, he told me to go to New York and put myself in the environment where the competition is the greatest. And basically, I was sink or swim. But he was there to, you know, to help me. But he also told me that my competition was him and everybody else that played the drums, that, you know, lived in New York or that played jazz. So it is extremely competitive. And I feel like without these types of mentors and without apprenticeships, you don't really have the same chance. You know, you're not on the scene in the same way. You know, somebody has to show you the ropes. And that's how jazz has always been. And that's, you know, what the foundation of the music is, passed down from one person to another.
I'm going to play you a little more of your music again. This is from your record, TLC and Friends. You were 16. Here is La Bonita. Bear with me as I connect these dots, because I'm listening to this music you as a young person playing, and I'm thinking about newly elected Boston Mayor Michelle Wu last night in her victory speech, saying that her sons asked her, hey, can a boy run for mayor too? Which was a framework for them, because they only knew a girl running for mayor. Would your music then have been different in any way if you'd been seeing girls all around you?
Well, I'm not sure how different it would be, but I would suspect that it would be different, because I'm always compared to men. And as far as I was concerned, I had to play as good as the next guy. And that was what I tried to do. I didn't want anybody to say I played like a girl, because I would have taken that not as a compliment. Now I feel like we have to embrace our differences and be open to a possible different aesthetic in the music, based on our gender identity. And I was never open to that before. And now I am. So I try to embrace it within myself more. It worked out for me because I was a tomboy growing up, and I always wanted to, you know, play with the boys and play sports, even though I wasn't very good at it. But I wanted to do the things that the boys did. And I think some young women, you know, naturally aren't that way, and nor should they have to be able to make it in jazz.
Are there women or non-binary artists who have really influenced you?
Well, I believe in mutual mentorship. So my students influence me all the time. I have so many students that I learn from. I think it helps me to remain relevant. It keeps me up to date with what's happening and keeps my ideas fresh. So I would have to say yes, you know, to that in some ways. But just as far as, you know, my main influences, there weren't very many women at all, you know, while I was developing. So, you know, unfortunately, I don't have any mentors that were female.
And that's really what this is about, right? is 10 years from now, I get to talk to another jazz artist who answers that question differently.
Yes, that is exactly what it's about. But it's not women mentoring women. It's everybody mentoring women. So our band leaders will be both male and female, because a big part of this program is for the people that have benefited the most from, you know, oppressive structure that we've been dealing with. I mean, I think they have a real responsibility to help change it as well.
What are you hearing from musicians in the jazz community about this program? What's the response been?
Well, we just launched a couple of days ago, so I haven't heard a whole lot.
Early days.
Yeah, but I mean, in general, all the work that I do with the Institute has been embraced by most of my male colleagues. And I mean, what I find interesting is either people are progressive or they're not. And it often doesn't boil down to their gender, because there are women that they don't want to be a part of anything that is centered around women, because, you know, we've been trained well to think that that means it's not as good, or that we're bringing attention to the fact that women, and people, you know, will say to me all the time, I'm not a woman this or a woman that, you know, I'm just, you know, just a musician, or I'm just, and I understand that, because that's how I felt, and that was my response as well years ago. But, you know, as I said, now I'm trying to embrace what might make me different and embrace all the sides of myself.
You mentioned, you know, founding Berklee's Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. So let's fast forward 10 years. You're looking at jazz 10 years from now. You're thinking back on this week when you launched this program. How might music be transformed?
How might music be transformed? Well, I think the most important thing is that we're trying to transform the culture. You know, and I think the music will tell its own story, but we're trying to shift the narrative. And so far, that narrative has remained pretty heavily on men play the instruments and women sing. That's kind of in the unspoken narrative that I've seen in jazz. And you always have a few women that pop up that play great, but then there are the exceptions. And we're trying to, you know, make help the culture change to not accepting that there are a few women that are exceptions, but we want to have women that are great, women that are mediocre, you know, all throughout the entire ecosystem.
And who should apply? How can they apply?
Well, they can apply online. They just look up Next Jazz Legacy or go to New Music USA website. They should find it. And I can't remember if we made the age limit 32 or something like that. And you have to be 21, I think. But yeah, I think if you're if you consider yourself an emerging artist, then you should apply.
All right. And we'll have that information on our website at radioboston.org. Terry Lynn Carrington, chair of the Next Jazz Legacy and founder of the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'd like to go out on some more music by Terry Lynn. This is she with an accompanying all-female band covering the Mary Lou Williams song Pisces for the Library of Congress. That's our show for today.